All right, so there's this international nuclear black market where they smuggle, I don't know, switches and vacuum tubes and stolen secrets and technology. Mostly goes by the name of the AQ Khan Network after the father of the Pakistani bomb, who apparently was a major kingpin in this network of nuclear proliferation. Of course, he doesn't run it now. There are at least some indications that the darn thing still exists. But here's what we know. We know that Libya, Iran, and North Korea all got equipment from this network. We know that the Iranians got the furthest with it and were revealed to be spinning centrifuges or, you know, having the equipment working on spinning centrifuges to enrich uranium to a mere 3.6%, which you can't possibly use to make a nuclear weapon. But still, they went around all the basically American-imposed sanctions and went to the black market and got this stuff. We know that the North Koreans bought some uranium enrichment equipment from the AQ Khan network. There's no evidence whatsoever that they ever used any of it. Of course, when the North Koreans actually did test their nuclear bombs, as expected over at antiwar.com, but a shocking surprise to Broad and Sanger at the New York Times, it was made of plutonium harvested from their Soviet-era reactors. Still, there remains to be seen a single atom of evidence that they ever used any of the Pakistani equipment to enrich uranium. And the Libyans, of course, just had it stacked in boxes in a warehouse and gave it up as part of the deal where the Bush administration actually finally allowed Libya to kiss up to the West, which they'd been trying to do for years and years. But they had to wait till the war in Iraq was over so that they could give the war in Iraq credit for Libya coming over. So anyway, that's what we know about the major axis of evil states and their participation in this AQ Khan network. But the more that seems to come out about this thing, the more for a loop I'm thrown, I guess, is the way to say it, because I never really can tell who's running this thing. Apparently, the CIA has known that AQ Khan stole these centrifuge plans from the Urenco company, the Urenco Consortium in Europe back in the 1970s. They turned a blind eye to the entire Pakistani bomb program in the 1980s while they were helping us help the Mujahideen fight the Russians in Afghanistan. And of course, the Sibel Edmonds case has at least indicated, if not proven, that there are Americans, not people likely to be working undercover for any intelligence agency, who are in on this network and making their ends in a big way, perhaps you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, in participating in this nuclear black market. We know it has. It was at least investigated, if not participated in, by Valerie Plame's group at the CIA, Brewster Jennings and Associates, which was outed by the vice president's office. And well, so there's a big, giant mystery, and there's some background. But now Luke Ryland is here, and Luke Ryland really knows this stuff. He's been following the case of Sibel Edmonds for a long time now. He's a proprietor of the blog LetSibelEdmondsSpeak.com. He also writes regularly at the Daily Coast. Welcome back to the show, Luke.
Good to speak to you.
So tell me, Luke, I guess basically I just said a whole bunch of stuff about this AQ Khan network, basically my brief sketch understanding of what's going on here. Before we really get into the details, was there anything that really needed correcting in what I said, do you think?
No, that was a pretty good summary, as always, from you, Scott. The interesting thing that I want to pick up with that you mentioned is that, you know, if the participants in the network or the customers are part of the axis of evil, then, as you say, you know, the Bush administration is very interested in making a big brouhaha about that and targeting their, you know, military machine at those customers. If there are allies that are participating in the network, then the U.S. Government turns a blind eye to their involvement.
Right. And, yeah, same thing for when it's neocons here in the United States, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, speaking of allies. All right, well, so yeah, let's talk about this this AQ Khan thing. My best understanding here really is that what he sold, Iran, North Korea, Libya, was the leftover junk from the Pakistanis' garage sale. This was not the best stuff that they use in order to make their nuclear weapons. This was the garbage they had left over, right?
Well, that's true as far as we know, but, you know, as far as the information that is public. But those three countries that you mentioned, Libya, North Korea, and Iran, are the only three countries that ever get named as customers of the network. Reportedly, up to 12 different countries, you know, have bought product from AQ Khan, and for some reason or other, those nine countries, you know, never get mentioned.
Well, I guess there's this new New York Times story. It's, again, by Broad and Sanger, who I guess are in the Olympic contest versus Judy Miller and Michael Gordon for who can make up the most stuff in the New York Times. And these guys have consistently, these two, Broad and Sanger, have consistently gotten this story wrong in major ways, including most especially sticking in my craw, their just acceptance of our government's assertions that the North Koreans were enriching uranium with a secret uranium enrichment program, which of course was never proven. They literally acted surprised when it turned out that the North Korean nuke that they tested was based on plutonium, not uranium. So I already have a bone to pick with these two extremely lousy, sloppy reporters at the New York Times. But now they have this new article, In Nuclear Net's Undoing, A Web of Shadowy Deals. And this starts to get into, you know, the CIA's angle on this network, how far into this network the CIA was, and what was going on with that. And they do mention other countries involved in the New York Times article. They talk about how some of the CIA dealings with the AQ Khan network, if you want to call them that, went through Malaysia, that they had some kind of secret program in Malaysia. Is that right?
Well, the head of the particular ring, you know, this story is about the Tinner family, ostensibly, but that particular procurement ring that the Tinners were involved with, these are the Swiss family, was run by, you know, AQ Khan obviously at the top, but then BSA Tahir, who is a Malaysian citizen. In fact, he was married to a woman whose father was a retired diplomat. So, you know, it starts to get pretty spooky quite quickly. But he was running his operation basically from Dubai, which is a free trade port basically, which means that products can come in and out very easily without being checked, you know, to see what's in the tank. This particular procurement ring was exposed when, in back in 2003, when a ship called BBC China was on its way to Libya with product from this particular ring, which included, you know, the Tinners, as we've mentioned, but also a couple of Turkish guys called Salim Algudez and Junes Çire. So a lot of the product came through Turkey. Turkey was a key supplier to the network as well, both in manufacturing particular, you know, hardware, but also as a transshipment point, just as Dubai was.
Now, is there any indication that these guys were working for the CIA as well?
Well, it's interesting when you look at the record of the people in this ring that was busted, you know, none of them got any jail time. One of them got 4 months, I think, in jail, but that, you know, that was about it. So all the Tinner family have just been basically pardoned by the US government, effectively. And when you look through the other participants in the ring, all of them have received the same treatment. I can't say specifically that the Turkish guys were working for the CIA, but, you know, neither of those guys got charged either. And this is an important point. The AQ Khan network, or this particular ring, appears to be operating today. And all of the companies that were, you know, dealing in the network are all freely operating today, including companies in the United States.
Yeah, you were asking about whether the Turkish guys were part of the CIA operation or whether they were working for the CIA. And I don't know the specific answer, but if you look at the treatment that the Tinners got, effectively being pardoned by the US government, and you look at all of the other players in the network, all of them got similar treatment. You essentially no jail time, and all of their companies are still operating freely.
Now, according to this New York Times story, what the Tinners were doing is they were supplying this network, but in working with the CIA, they were sabotaging the vacuum tubes, sabotaging different pieces of equipment. And it's interesting because you think back about some of the massive failures that the uranium program has had. There was a few different occasions, I believe, where their centrifuges flew apart into a million pieces, weren't working right at all. At least in one case, it was blamed on the microbes in the oils on a fingerprint left on one of the centrifuges, that kind of thing. This story here says that the CIA, the Tinners, in working for the CIA, were sabotaging this equipment that they were selling to the Iranians and to others.
Right. Well, I don't know any of the specifics on that, but yeah, the New York Times did report that that was a CIA operation that blew up the uranium program. Mm-hmm. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. And when you read the New York Times article, you can see that all they do is quote, you know, U.S. government press officers. So it's hard to, you know, the guys didn't do, Sanger and Broad didn't do any objective reporting there at all. So it's hard to peer through and see what's real and what's nonsense.
Yeah, it's a real problem in having to rely on the New York Times for any of this stuff. I guess here's what I'm really trying to understand here, Luke, and I don't know if you really know the answer to this, but I guess it sort of seems like you have factions within the government, or at least individuals within the government, who, as Sybelle Edmonds has indicated, were participating in this nuclear black market ring, protecting people involved in it here in the United States, and making their ends that way. Does it seem right that the CIA was trying to stop this thing, really trying to thwart this ring, or they were running this damn thing from the beginning? I mean, why didn't they stop AQCon 25 years ago?
I was just about to say, as you said in the setup, the CIA was aware of this activity going back to 1976, and in fact twice asked the Dutch government not to arrest AQCon. So they were watching it all, you know, from the absolute genesis, and they watched the Pakistani program be developed. You know, Richard Barlow's case, he was the U.S. government's expert on Pakistan's nuclear program, and he set up a few sting operations and tried to arrest a few people, and people within the U.S. government kept on sabotaging his, you know, arrests. So the U.S. government has watched the whole program from the beginning, so it's a little bit difficult to understand what's going on. And, you know, if they argue that it's a sting operation, then it's completely failed because Pakistan got the bomb and have sent their plans and blueprints to, as I say, up to 12 different countries. And the important thing when you come back to Sybelle Edmonds' case is that, you know, she reports that the program wasn't a state-to-state operation. There was a lot of individual players who were, you know, selling stuff on the nuclear black market. And once that information gets out there, then there's no telling where the technology ends up, including in the hands of terrorist groups.
Well, yeah, and this is something that has always been interesting to me. She says that she, well, I don't know if she said this outright, but I think it's pretty safe to say we know that this is what she means, that she overheard on some of the intercepts while working for the FBI, Mark Grossman warn members, Mark Grossman being a neocon and a career employee type at the State Department, that she overheard him warning members of this black market to beware of Brewster, Jennings, and Associates. They're not to be trusted. That's the agency looking out, you know, working against us. And turns out that was where Valerie Plame worked. And when Robert Novak broke the story, it said the name of Brewster Jennings, Valerie Plame's front company, on CNN in 2003. Well, I guess only the stragglers inside the network were being clued into anything. Mark Grossman had already tipped them off 2 years before.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Sybelle's case deals with a lot of things. Only one of them is the nuclear black market. But this Mark Grossman, who you mentioned, he used to be the ambassador to Turkey and was then promoted to a couple of different positions. And during the time that you mentioned, was the number three guy at the State Department. He was facilitating a number of different mechanisms for extracting information from the U.S. government and supplying the nuclear black market network, all for personal profit. One thing they were doing was, you know, installing PhD students who were moles, foreign PhD students who were moles, in every nuclear lab in the country and every nuclear agency. So they were planting moles there to, you know, suck out information, which was then reported back to, let's say, the Turkish embassy in the U.S., and then that information then went from the Turkish embassy, I think, to the Israeli embassy and the Pakistani embassy, and then back into the AQCon network and elsewhere. You know, a lot of the people that Sybelle heard on these wiretaps were, you know, even though they might have been facilitating the stuff for, let's say, Pakistan, they were, you know, they'd make a copy of the information as it passed through their hands, and then go and sell that to, you know, whoever wanted to buy it.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's no indication, is there, that the Turks are actually working on a bomb of their own, right? This is just the Turkish deep state making money on the black market.
Well, there's no evidence that the Turkish government is working on a nuclear weapon, but they have been working on a nuclear program, and earlier this year they announced, you know, plans to start enriching uranium in Turkey, and opened up their, you know, contracting to foreign businesses to help facilitate that. Now, Turkey has had a long had a problem with the nuclear black market. including but not limited to the two guys that I mentioned earlier. Back in the year 2000, President Clinton tried to sign an executive order to allow Turkey access to U.S. nuclear technology, but there were a couple of whistleblowers, we don't know who they were, in the U.S. government who threatened to, it appears, threatened to out, you know, certain activities. So the Clinton administration had to put a hold on that deal to supply Turkey with nuclear technology. Just earlier this year, you know, the UK Times, Sunday Times, started reporting on the nuclear black market of element of Sabell's case, and just a few weeks later, President Bush signed another executive order allowing Turkey to have this technology. So there's a lot of suspicious activity going on in Turkey, including supplying the network, and, you know, who knows what else they're up to.
Wow. You know, it's amazing how much George Bush Jr. has in common with Bill Clinton, because that was exactly what Clinton did when the Justice Department began investigating some of the technology transfers to China, which, whether you think they were a good idea or not or don't care, were illegal at the time. And Clinton then signed waivers during the investigation, signed waivers legalizing what had been done criminally. And it sounds like that's exactly what George Bush did here in this case with Turkey.
That's certainly my working hypothesis, yeah.
Incredible. All right, now, a big part of this Times article by Broad and Sanger is what's not in there. And what you do in your blog entry at letsabelledmondspeak.com and at dailycoast.com, and again, the name, the blogger name is Lukery, Luke Ryland, Lukery Land. You can find him at the Daily Coast, letsabelledmondspeak.com. But what you do here is you fill in some of the omissions the Broad and Sanger felt fit to leave out of their New York Times article. So you've already mentioned this guy, Tahir, and I'm not going to try to pronounce the names of these Turkish guys, but why don't you just, you know, take us through the list here. Explain who some of these people are, what your understanding is about their involvement in this network, and why, I don't know, apparently you think they're important enough that they should have been included in the newspaper of record.
Right. Well, you know, we have these Turkish guys, and then we have another Turkish guy in the U.S., a guy called Zeki Bilmen. Now, Sabell apparently overheard him dealing with, I believe, the Turkish embassy in the United States, facilitating the transfer of nuclear hardware. Now, Sabell finished at the FBI in early 2002 and translated wiretaps starting back in 1996. So during that period, she heard evidence of this Zeki Bilmen and his company, Giza Technologies, based in New Jersey, you know, facilitating the transfer of nuclear technology. Now, he was officially busted in 2003, I believe, when he sold some what they call spark gaps, or the centrifuges, I guess, to an Israeli businessman based in South Africa called Asher Khani. Now, Khani then sent the gaps to the Pakistan military. So there's another element, again, in the U.S. that's been covered up by, you know, not only the New York Times, but just about everybody else. The LA Times did run a story about it in 2004. So, again, we've got the Turkish connection there. And there are a couple of other people that I've mentioned there. Peter Griffin, who was a British man. Now, there was a multi-million-dollar four-year investigation into his activities. Now, that investigation was dropped just earlier this year, too. And then there was another manufacturing plant in South Africa. The point is that all of these guys, you know, were busted for doing very serious things, being key participants in the Khan network, and they've all gone free. Now, the New York Times, for one reason or other, chose not to mention it or any of this, and my hypothesis is that they were, you know, by focusing just on the Kinner family and, again, misreporting even that, they've allowed these Turkish guys and the Turkish connection to be whitewashed from, you know, the public knowledge of what's going on. And not just Turkey as well, but, you know, a lot of this network was based in Dubai, which is a key money laundering, you know, center for this activity and other activities as well. Again, they're allies of the U.S. It appears that the New York Times, acting as a government mouthpiece, doesn't want these pieces of information made public. I mean, you know, they're public, but not publicized.
Yeah, it's interesting, the editorial policy there. Of course, as you said in some of your opening comments there, anything that has to do with Iran, oh boy, that gets all the coverage. Anything that has to do with North Korea, well, Broad and Sanger can't wait to help the Bush administration indict them.
Right. I mean, if you look at the latest piece there by Borden Sanger, you know, it's basically a warmongering piece against Iran. It's a four-page article that was placed on the front page of the New York Times. Now, if you go to the final page, the fourth page, you'll see a quote saying there's no evidence that Iran got any of these designs from this particular network. So, you know, it's nice of them to bury that at the end of the article.
There's no evidence that the Iranians got what?
Take it back a step. Back in May of this year, the Swiss government, the Tinner family were arrested in 2004 and have been sort of awaiting trial since then. But the US government doesn't want them on trial because that would expose the fact that they were working for the US government. So in May of this year, the Swiss government announced that they had destroyed 30,000 pages of evidence relating to the Tinner case. Some of that evidence was bomb design, apparently. Other evidence included contracts with the CIA and other such information that would be, embarrassing to the CIA. So back in May, you know, the big story was that the Swiss government had destroyed all this information at the behest of the CIA, basically to keep the Tinners out of court. Some of the headline stories at the time indicated that there was a complete set of nuclear bombs that could fit, miniature nuclear bombs that could fit on a mini warhead, you know, which made it very dangerous. Mm. So that's the reason why all this information was destroyed, purportedly. At the time, you know, there was all these threats about whether Al-Qaeda or Iran got the information. And if you look at the latest New York Times article, it says Iran about 50 times. And at the bottom of the page, it says, oh, there's no evidence that Iran got any of this information.
Right. And, of course, it wouldn't make any sense whatsoever because, well, correct me if I'm wrong, you obviously know much more about this than me, but the so-called bomb design in question is for a plutonium bomb, right?
I believe this is another type of bomb. This is the bomb that Pakistan exploded in 1998.
Okay.
That's what the argument was.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that the Iranians could shut down their nuclear reactors and keep them off for a year and then spend another year or more going through the process of attempting to harvest weapons-grade plutonium out of their reactors to make one of these bombs, assuming they have the rest of the technology to make it fire right and everything else, which there's no evidence that they have. But this was not a plan for how to make a bomb out of uranium, which is actually the basis for all the accusations against Iran, that they're trying to perfect the enrichment of uranium so that once they're really good at it, I guess the fantasy is that they will then withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, kick the inspectors out, and start making a bomb out of that. So, you know, none of this is really consistent at all. In fact, it almost seemed like perhaps it was part of the same narrative of disinformation when they started talking again at the same time that this Tinner stuff was coming out. They started bringing up the so-called North Korean-Syrian nuclear reactor that supposedly was going to make plutonium for an Iranian bomb. And, like, you know, here's just a bunch of garbage all crammed together into one narrative. It's almost like they're trying to lie us into war in Iraq again or something.
Yeah, it certainly looks like that. And the key point here is that if you're looking, and this is why, you know, my first article yesterday mentioned those people, and my upcoming article, which will be out in a couple of days, talks about, you know, which countries are involved in this activity. And Iran, you know, isn't even, you know, up on the list, really. So you've got Sanger and Broad pushing the Iran narrative, but you've got U.S. allies who are, when you look at the facts, are much more complicit in this sort of activity, and we should be bombing them, arguably. I'm not arguing for that, but, you know, along the same lines, you've got countries like Turkey who are much more in these activities than Iran is.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if the war party wanted to make sure that the Iranians didn't buy a ready-made plutonium core on the black market somehow, which I haven't seen any indication that you actually have, you know, bomb-ready material being sold in this market so far. You can tell me if you know otherwise. But if they really wanted to stop that, well, maybe they shouldn't have outed Brewster Jennings and Associates, which it was their job, right? Plame was working on Iran. That was her job, was making sure that that's the kind of thing that did not happen.
Right.
Supposedly, anyway, I don't know.
It's funny, in the latest New York Times article, they say the reason that they interrupted the Swiss prosecution of the Tinners was for two reasons. One, because it would lead to embarrassing revelations about the CIA's relationship with the Tinners. And secondly, because I didn't want to deter future moles from working with the CIA. If one of their moles gets thrown in prison, i.e. the tinners, then it'll be hard to recruit new moles. That's their argument. And as you say, they did exactly the same thing to Valerie Plame, their own agent. So, you know, there's a certain, let me say, irony there.
Yeah. Well, and also we're talking about Switzerland, the neutral country where everybody does their banking and never has a war with them. And they're not supposed to be taking part in stuff like this. And it's my understanding that for a private citizen in Switzerland to be part of a covert operation of a second country against a third is a big time crime in that country, that these guys under the laws of the Swiss state ought to be going to prison. But instead, they're going along with what the CIA says.
That's exactly right. It certainly caused an uproar in Switzerland. You know, at the time, the president made the announcement on May 31, and he said, oh, we had to destroy all of this information so that which was in their hands. And just parenthetically, there's also multiple copies of it existing in the black market anyway. He said we had to destroy this information so that it didn't get in the hand of terrorists and rogue states, which was just complete nonsense. So that caused an uproar. The court system wasn't aware of it. Parliament was in an uproar. Interestingly, just prior to that, they destroyed that information. The announcement was made in May, but they destroyed all of that information back in November 2007. So they kept it secret for 6 months. Immediately prior to that, I think it was the Attorney General of Switzerland came to visit the CIA and to ask what he could do or not. So he met with the CIA and they said, well, you know, give us all the information. He also met with the State Department, and they said, well, just destroy it because we don't want the bombs to get into the hands of terrorists. But very interestingly, he also met with the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, and head of the FBI, Robert Mueller.
Really?
In other words, now, as you know, those guys only have domestic jurisdiction. So why is the Swiss Attorney General meeting with Mueller and Gonzalez? Obviously, there are key U.S. citizens who are involved in domestic activity that was supplying this network as well, criminal activity.
Did Mueller and Gonzalez go to Switzerland?
No, the Swiss guy came to visit them in the U.S.
I see. Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah, and you know, coming back to Sabell's case, she overheard wiretaps of companies like Giza Technology and people at the American-Turkish Council facilitating this sort of activity. So there are U.S. persons involved in this, probably not as a part of the CIA's operation. They're freelancing, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Sabell's been calling for public open hearings so that this stuff can be exposed, because that endangers, you know, not only the U.S. public safety, but also, you know, the safety of people all around the world.
Yes,
she wants public open hearings. She's been calling for them for 6 years now. And any congressman can call hearings or read the information into the public record. For 6 years, nothing's happened. So, you know, hopefully one of the congressmen will stand up soon and invite her to testify. Not only her, but also the FBI agents that she worked with, who are also outraged about this sort of activity. And they've been silenced by, you know, various means, but they're all willing to come and testify under oath too.
Yeah, well, it sounds like there's a lot to cover up here in terms of covert operations that, you know, may or may not be looked upon kindly by the American people, but also individual criminality, including members of both parties. And so nobody has any sort of motivation to do anything about this, do they, in Congress?
Well, but you're exactly right. It's a bipartisan problem because it has been going on for years. And, you know, Sabell had hearings with congressmen of two different parties, Charles Grassley and Patrick Leahy, for example, Democrat and Republican. You know, the first thing they did was say, well, this sounds like a sting operation. We better go and check. So they went and checked, you know, with the FBI and CIA, came back and said, oh, no, actually, it's not a sting operation. This is criminal activity. Let's proceed. But then they were shut down and haven't done anything since.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. There appears to be no incentive for any congressman to stand up and hold these hearings because it will damage his or her party in the process.
And by the way,
there's an honest congressman left somewhere, Scott. I'm not confident, but hopefully there's one there somewhere.
Yeah, well, doesn't it matter which committee they're on or not? Any congressman can do something?
Well, I think, I'm not sure of the exact details. There are certain committees, obviously, but there are, you know, I would guess at least 10 different committees that could hold hearings into this case. But I believe that any congressman can read any of this classified information into the public record. For example, the Department of Justice Inspector General did a report into Sabel's case, a classified report,
right.
still classified report, that validated everything that she said, as far as we know, and any congressman can read that into the public record.
Hmm. Well, there's very few to choose from, but there are a couple of good men up there. We'll see. By the way, Philip Giraldi, a former CIA operator, I guess he was the station chief in Turkey, is that right? I forget. Anyway, he was on this show, and he said it is inconceivable that the CIA would use somebody like, say, Mark Grossman, for example, at the State Department as part of some sting operation on this level, this kind of thing. And there is no way the CIA would not even ask, and the State Department would say hell no anyway.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And you had Joe Lauria, one of the co-authors of the UK Sunday Times series on Sabel's case, on your show just recently.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he'd heard that a lot of the US media, which has been, you know, remarkably silent on Sabel's case, had been told not to write about it because, you know, it was a sting operation. Now, this is after the UK Times did a three-part series on the story. So, you know, if there was a sting operation in place, hypothetically, you know, it had already been exposed by the UK Times and, you know, anyone else over the last 6 years that's been paying any attention.
Right,
but
that would
US
be...
US media accepts that, oh, okay, it's a sting operation, we're not going to write about it, even though, you know, it's just nonsense at face value.
Right, of course, a sting operation on this level is a great news story, if that's what it is, but... You know, another thing that Lauria talked about was trying to get, I think, one of the editors or something, one of his bosses at the Boston Globe to let him write about this for the Boston Globe, and they just couldn't hear it. Couldn't hear it. What do you mean? Like actual, real, international criminality by some of the most powerful people in America? Come on. Nah, couldn't be. So just, I don't even want to hear it, they told him. They just could not even understand how, you know, even open their mind to the possibility. And he said, I forget his exact words, but something to the effect of, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. They just can't see it at all.
Right. And then on the other hand, you get guys like William Broad and David Sanger writing for the New York Times that just get spoon-fed information from press officers and write it up verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, this story broke in Switzerland on May 31. New York Times was silent on it for 2 weeks, I think, until June 16, when they finally wrote a story and said, oh, you know, there are these complete bomb plans floating around and we have no idea who's got them. Obviously being fed by their CIA sources, you know, it took them 2.5 weeks to even write about it. Now we have it, you know, 2 months, 3 months later, and they're saying, oh, actually, sorry about that. There wasn't actually a complete bomb, and there's no way that terrorists could use it. But, you know, they don't apologize for their earlier reporting, which was a complete scare tactic and designed to cover up this particular story that's come out in the US media just now. It was the CIA that destroyed all the evidence in the Swiss case to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, was it James Risen that wrote the story about how they had hired, I think, a Russian to funnel some bomb plans, but that were deliberately done wrong in just a couple of places? But it turned out that the built-in mistakes, were so obvious that what they amounted to were actual bomb plans. The CIA just furnished, you know, the best kind of bomb plans they could straight to the Iranians in an attempt to frame them, basically.
Right, that was called Operation Merlin, yeah. And, you know, as you say, the CIA have been watching Khan and his network since 1976. What have they got to show for their efforts? Absolutely nothing. They did that thing with Operation Merlin that you've just described, and in this current article in the New York Times, they talk about Turkey, these guys in Turkey sending centrifuge motors to Iran that got, you know, 50 motors that got blown up or something that you mentioned earlier. Now, there's a quote in the article that says the Iranians now check, you know, they test the motors before they use them. You know, it's pretty simple stuff. And in the meantime, you know, there's all this presumed bomb plans that were on this CD that the Tinners had has been passed around to God knows how many people. So, you know, this information, the CIA have been watching it, and they can't argue that they were watching it, you know, to keep a control of the network because it's got completely out of hand and all this information has been distributed to, you know, God knows who.
Well, first of all, let me remind the audience, for those just tuning in, I'm talking with Luke Ryland. He is the proprietor of the blog Let Sibel Edmund Speak. blogspot.com. He also blogs over there with the Democrats at the Daily Kos. And one of the major themes in the Sibel Edmund story and in all this nuclear black market stuff is the role of the foreign lobbyists here in the United States. The American-Turkish Council, there's another one involved, I forget the name of it, just like it. And this seems to all kind of also surround or have something to do with so-called legitimate arms sales to countries like Turkey, NATO expansion, and that kind of thing. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, no, anything?
Yeah, exactly. And I think Justin Raimondo has a piece there today on the foreign lobbyists. Earlier this year, Sibel put a, as you know, she's gagged with the state secret privilege gag and a number of other gags, so she isn't allowed to say very much. But what she very cleverly found a way to expose some of the people who are the guilty parties in her case. She checked up the law, and she's allowed to publish public photos of public figures. So she put up on her website a thing called the State Secrets Privilege Gallery or some such. Now, that's broken up into three different sections. The first section has the State Department and Pentagon officials, Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, Brent Scowcroft, and Larry Franklin and others in the first section. The second section is a list of current and former congressmen, some of them who were, she knows were bribed by the Turkish lobby, guys like Dennis Hastert, Tom Lantos, Roy Blunt, and then she also has the ex-congressmen who are doing the bribing, Stephen Solars, ex-Democrat congressman, and Bob Livingston, and, you know, another powerful ex-congressman. And so there's this system where the Turkish lobby bribes certain congressmen for various reasons and then uses them, you know, I guess they catch them on tape or whatever, accepting the money, and then they can leverage that into higher and higher bribes. To get more and more favors. So you have the current congressman being bribed by former congressmen who were, you know, bribed when they were congressmen by other congressmen. So the Turkish lobby is very good at doing this. And Richard Perle and Douglas Feith were, you know, they were lobbyists for Turkey back in the day too.
It's notable that Livingston and Hastert are the two men who succeeded Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House of Representatives. These aren't just nobodies in the Congress. These are the leaders of the House.
Right, and I'm sure that's no accident. Although in Hastert's case, for example, you know, they had him going back, they were bribing him going back to 1996 or 97, which was when he was a nobody. But a lot of the illegal activity conducted by Turkish interests in the United States, particularly a lot of the drug dealing, drug smuggling, involved in, you know, Chicago, Illinois, and that's Hastert's home territory. So they might have got him for that reason. You know, he was a nobody and was somehow promoted to Speaker of the House. And whether they had a role in facilitating that, I don't know.
And when you talk about him being on the payroll from back in the 1990s, this investigation goes back to the 1990s. That's why you can know that, or how you can know that, right?
Oh, exactly. Yep. There are four congressmen that Sibel knows that were bribed by the Turkish interests. And back in 1998, the Clinton administration, Janet Reno, in fact, one of your favorites, went about appointing a special prosecutor to, you know, investigate these crimes. They had so much evidence, all on the FBI wiretaps. You know, this stuff is indisputable. As happens with a lot of these cases, particularly involving Turkey, that investigation was shut down as well. In fact, it wasn't even an investigation at that point. You know, there was a special prosecutor involved.
Now, the FBI, they kept their investigation open. They just didn't do anything.
Well, Sibel was very careful to point this out, that a lot of the investigations that she was involved in was in counterintelligence, which was basically a monitoring service. Counterintelligence, you know, they just watch stuff and try and learn what's happening.
Well, and they have a lower threshold of evidence than if they're trying to get a criminal warrant for, this is where, you know, you go to the FISA court and get a rubber stamp rather than a real judge with a warrant for probable cause for a criminal investigation so that you can use the evidence in court later.
That's exactly right. And, you know, most or all of the stuff that Sibel translated came through FISA warrants. But when the FBI agents come across criminal activity involving U.S. persons, you know, they're supposed to hand that investigation over to counterterrorism or counter-narcotics. Now, whenever the FBI agents in Sibel's case tried to do that, they got shut down, and the investigations got shut down. These people have been getting away with it since 1996 at a minimum.
Yeah. Well, now, first of all, to the audience, my friend Luke here is calling from the other side of the planet in Tasmania. That's why there's a little delay on the line. I'm sorry I keep interrupting you, even though you can't hear me interrupt you for another few seconds after I start. It's a really bad way to conduct an interview. But please tell me more about Fife and Pearl's role in this, because their names come up all the time, and yet very little clarity surrounds the accusations about their involvement in whether it's drugs, the nuclear black market, whatever it is that Sybil Edmonds seems to have found out about them.
Well, as you know, as Phil Giraldi said on your show, you know, when you asked him about it, Richard Pearl is an agent of influence for Israel, and there's a CIA report floating around that specifically states that. There is a strange military relationship between Turkey, the U.S., and Israel. And when Pearl and Fife were out of office back in the late 80s, I believe, they set up a company called, a lobbying company called International Advisors, Inc., that was, you know, I think it was a $600,000 or $700,000 per year contract to lobby for Turkey. Their activities drew a lot of unwanted attention. There was a 1996 article in the Wall Street Journal that basically exposed them. So they shut down the International Advisors Inc. and then went about setting up the American Turkish Council, which was modelled on, you know, the Israeli lobby, AIPAC. Sybil calls AIPAC and ATC sister organisations. And there were sister investigations. The same investigations that she talks about on the Turkish side were also taking place on the Israeli side, and coming up with a lot of the same answers and a lot of the same people. Now, we don't know exactly what Pearl and Fife did specifically, apart from the fact that this ATC that they set up is the nexus of this nuclear black market in the United States. It's also the center for a lot of the drug narcotics trafficking in the United States. That's why the FBI was originally looking at it. And as you said, the CIA was looking at the American Turkish Council because of their role in the nuclear black market. Now, there's another element to Pearl and Fife's involvement. Again, their names aren't specifically attached to this. But if you look at the first of the Sunday Times article on Sybil's case, she said that there were people at the Pentagon who maintained a database of individuals and the information that they had access to. So let's say people at the American Turkish Council wanted particular classified information. They would call somebody at the Pentagon, and let's say that person was Richard Pearl, who would then look at his database and say, ah, I know who has access to that information. Let's say that person was Larry Franklin. Larry Franklin's personal weaknesses are that he's gay, or that he has money problems, or that he likes prostitutes, or whatever, whatever the hook might be. And then the operatives, the Turkish and Israeli operatives, would then go and recruit Franklin using one of these hooks.
Wait a minute. Wait, right there, Luke. Let me make sure I understand you here. You're saying that people like Pearl, from his official position at, say, the Defense Policy Board, or just, you know, from sitting in his office at the American Turkish Council or something, has access to the FBI's files on all the people that he wants to blackmail? Is that what you're saying there?
Well, exactly where he got that information from, we're not sure. It's not publicly available, and
okay,
I certainly don't know.
So we don't know that this is Justice Department information that he has, just that they have a database that they keep.
They have a personal database that they keep for this exact purpose, yeah.
I see. I was thinking, you know, what, like J. Edgar Hoover type thing, where blackmailing everybody in town kind of do. But I see what you're saying.
Well, they're blackmailing a lot of people in town, sure, but it appears to be, you know, for personal and profit reasons.
Now, please elaborate what you know about Brent Scowcroft, other than that Sybil Edmonds posted his picture. Of course, I think it's an established fact that he was very much against Pearl and Fife, for example, in what American Middle East policy should be in the war on terrorism and so forth. And yet here he is in the very same rogues gallery. What do you know about Brent Scowcroft? That, again, that's General Scowcroft, George Bush Sr.'s alter ego.
Right. Well, when you look at Sybil's case, what becomes apparent is that these people are interested in profit, you know, for personal reasons. That there's no ideology. It doesn't matter if they're Democrats or State Department or Republicans or neocons. It all comes down to money. And a lot of the you know, presumed ideological differences, if they have any ideology, just melts away. Now, Scowcroft is the chairman of the American Turkish Council. this organization that Pearl and Fife established, which is the nexus of all of this activity in the United States. I don't know anything specifically involving any of his activities as they pertain to Sabell's case. But if you look at, you know, Sabell's case is essentially about a lot of these things, including, and sort of as an umbrella, the importance of Central Asia and the oil fields in the stands,
mm-hmm.
oil and energy fields in the stands. When you look at the American-Turkish Council, you know, a lot of their activities involved in these areas. And if you look at other organizations similar to the American-Turkish Council, whether it's the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan or any of these places, you see the same people on the boards there, including Scowcroft.
Mm-hmm. And now, yeah, she's mentioned that to me before in interviews, the ties of the Turkic countries to all the black markets, particularly in heroin and all that, the pipeline from Afghanistan through to Turkey and then for heroin distribution all throughout Europe and America and that kind of deal. But when she puts Brent Scowcroft's picture up on her page, she's saying more than just, well, he's the chairman of the thing or was or whatever, so he must be one of them. She's at least indicating or she's asserting, right, that she knows something about this guy. She just hasn't told us what yet because she's under state secrets privilege threat of prison if she does.
Yeah, she can't say anything about him, and she can't say anything about the others, really. But, you know, via various public information, we can put all of that, a lot of that case together. But given my interest in Sabell's case has been going on for 5 years or something, I'm very confident that she has something specific on Brent Scowcroft and everybody else on that list. She's not just playing guilt by association.
I see.
And
yeah.
If anybody's interested, they can go to my website, letsabelledmondspeak.blogspot.com, and on the top right-hand side there of the website, it says Sabell Names Names. So if you click on that, it'll take you to the photos and also the names of the people so you can see specifically who's involved.
All right, everybody, that's Luke Ryland on the phone from Tasmania. He is the proprietor of letsabelledmondspeak.blogspot.com. He's also written, cross-posted his latest one at the Daily Kos. It's called NY Times Does It Again, More Judy Miller Tap Dancing, a very apt title for the so-called latest work, or the latest so-called work of Broad and Sanger there at the Times. Thanks very much for your time today on the show.
Thank you again, Scott.